the paper that does the same experiment a year later and gets the same result? Even worse, what happens to papers that carry out the same experiment and don't find a significant result? For the system to work, those experiments need to be made public. Too often, they end up in the file drawer instead. But the culture is changing. Reformers with loud voices like Ioannidis and Simonson, who speak both to the scientific community and to the broader public, have generated a new sense of urgency about the danger of descent into large-scale haruspicy. In 2013, the Association for Psychological Science announced that they would start publishing a new genre of article called Registered Replication Reports. These reports, aimed at reproducing the effects reported in widely cited studies, are treated differently from usual papers in a crucial way. The proposed experiment is accepted for publication before the study is carried out. If the outcomes support the initial finding, great news. But if not, they're published anyway, so the whole community can know the full state of the evidence. Another consortium, the Many Labs Project, revisits high-profile findings in psychology and attempts to replicate them in large multinational samples. In November 2013, psychologists were cheered when the first suite of Many Labs results came back, finding that 10 of the 13 studies addressed were successfully replicated. In the end, of course, judgments must be made and lines drawn. What, after all, does Fisher really mean by the rarely and rarely fails? If we assign an arbitrary numerical threshold, say an effect is real if it reaches statistical significance in more than 90% of experiments, we may find ourselves in trouble again. Fisher, at any rate, didn't believe in a hard and fast rule that tells us what to do. He was a distruster of pure mathematical formalism. In 1956, near the end of his life, he wrote that, in fact, no scientific worker has a fixed level of significance at which, from year to year and in all circumstances, he rejects hypotheses. He rather gives his mind to each particular case in the light of his evidence and his ideas. In the next chapter, we will see one way in which the light of the evidence might be made more specific. Chapter 10. Are you there, God? It's me. Bayesian inference. The age of big data is frightening to a lot of people, and it's frightening in part because of the implicit promise that algorithms, sufficiently supplied with data, are better at inference than we are. Superhuman powers are scary. Beings that can change their shape are scary, beings that rise from the dead are scary, and beings that can make inferences that we cannot are scary. It was scary when a statistical model deployed by the guest marketing analytics team at Target correctly inferred, based on purchasing data, that one of its customers, guests, a teenaged girl in Minnesota, was pregnant based on an arcane formula involving elevated rates of buying unscented lotion, mineral supplements, and cotton balls. Target started sending her coupons for baby gear, much to the consternation of her father, who, with his puny human inferential power, was still in the dark. Spooky to contemplate, living in a world where Google and Facebook and your phone and, geez, even Target know more about you than your parents do. But it's possible we ought to spend less time worrying about eerily superpowered algorithms and more time worrying about crappy ones. For one thing, crappy might be as good as it gets. Yes, the algorithms that drive the businesses of Silicon Valley get more sophisticated every year, and the data fed to them more voluminous and nutritious. There's a vision of the future in which Google knows you, where by aggregating millions of micro-observations, how long did he hesitate before clicking on this? How long did his Google Glass linger on that? The central storehouse can predict your preferences, your desires, your actions, especially vis-a-vis what products you might want or might be persuaded to want. It might be that way, but it also might not. There are lots of mathematical problems where supplying more data improves the accuracy of the result in a fairly predictable way. If you want to predict the course of an asteroid, you need to measure its velocity and its position, as well as the gravitational effects of the objects in its astronomical neighborhood. The more measurements you can make of the asteroid and the more precise those measurements are, the better you're going to do at pinning down its track. But some problems are more like predicting the weather. That's another situation where having plenty of fine-grained data and the computational power to plow through it quickly can really help. In 1950, it took the early computer ENIAC 24 hours to simulate 24 hours of weather, and that was an astounding feat of space-age computation. In 2008, That computation was reproduced on a Nokia 6300 mobile phone in less than a second. Forecasts aren't just faster now, they're longer range and more accurate too. In 2010, a typical 5-day forecast was as accurate as a 3-day forecast had been in 1986. It's tempting to imagine that predictions will just get better and better as our ability to gather data gets more and more powerful. Won't we eventually have the whole atmosphere simulated to a high precision in a server farm somewhere under the Weather Channel's headquarters? Then, if you wanted to know next month's weather, you could just let the simulation run a little bit ahead. It's not going to be that way. Energy in the atmosphere burbles up very quickly from the tiniest scales to the most global, with the effect that even a minuscule change at one place in time can lead to a vastly different outcome only a few days down the road. Weather is, in the technical sense of the word, chaotic. In fact, it was in the numerical study of weather that Edward Lorenz discovered the mathematical notion of chaos in the first place. He wrote, "One meteorologist remarked that if the theory were correct, one flap of a seagull's wing would be enough to alter the course of the weather forever. The controversy has not yet been settled, but the most recent evidence seems to favor the seagulls." There's a hard limit to how far in advance we can predict the weather, no matter how much data we collect. Lorenz thought it was about 2 weeks, and so far, the concentrated efforts of the world's meteorologists have given us no cause to doubt that boundary. Is human behavior more like an asteroid or more like the weather? It surely depends on what aspect of human behavior you're talking about. In at least one respect, human behavior ought to be even harder to predict than the weather. We have a very good mathematical model for weather, which allows us at least to get better at short-range predictions when given access to more data, even if the inherent chaos of the system inevitably wins out. For human action, we have no such model and may never have one. That makes the prediction problem massively harder. In 2006, the online entertainment company Netflix launched a $1 million competition to see if anyone in the world could write an algorithm that did a better job than Netflix's own at recommending movies to customers. The finish line didn't seem very far from the start. The winner would be the first program to do 10% better at recommending movies than Netflix did. Contestants were given a huge file of anonymized ratings, about 1 million ratings in all, covering 17,700 movies and almost 500,000 Netflix users. The challenge was to predict how users would rate movies they hadn't seen. There's data, lots of data, and it's directly relevant to the behavior you're trying to predict. And yet, this problem is really, really hard. It ended up taking 3 years before anyone crossed the 10% improvement barrier, and it was only done when several teams banded together and hybridized their almost good enough algorithms into something just strong enough to collapse across the finish line. Netflix never even used the winning algorithm in its business. By the time the contest was over, Netflix was already transitioning from sending DVDs in the mail to streaming movies online, which makes dud recommendations less of a big deal. And if you've ever used Netflix or Amazon or Facebook or any other site that aims to recommend you products based on the data it's gathered about you, you know that the recommendations remain pretty comically bad. They might get a lot better as even more streams of data get integrated into your profile. But they certainly might not. Which, from the point of view of the companies doing the gathering, is not so bad. It would be great for Target if they knew with absolute certainty whether or not you were pregnant just from following the tracks of your loyalty card. They don't. But it would also be great if they could be 10% more accurate in their guesses about your gravidity than they are now. Same for Google. They don't have to know exactly what product you want. They just have to have a better idea than competing ad channels do. Businesses generally operate on thin margins. Predicting your behavior 10% more accurately isn't actually all that spooky for you, but it can mean a lot of money for them. I asked Jim Bennett, the vice president for recommendations at Netflix at the time of the competition, why they'd offered such a big prize. He told me I should have been asking why the prize was so small. A 10% improvement in their recommendations, small as that seems, would recoup the million in less time than it takes to make another Fast and Furious movie. Does Facebook know you're a terrorist? So, if corporations with access to big data are still pretty limited in what they know about you, what's to worry about? Try worrying about this. Suppose a team at Facebook decides to develop a method for guessing which of its users are likely to be involved in terrorism against the United States. Mathematically, it's not so different from the problem of figuring out whether a Netflix user is likely to enjoy Ocean's 13. Facebook generally knows its users' real names and locations, so it can use public records to generate a list of Facebook profiles belonging to people who have already been convicted of terroristic crimes or support of terrorist groups. Then the math starts. Do the terrorists tend to make more status updates per day than the general population, or fewer, or on this metric, do they look basically the same? Are there words that appear more frequently in their updates? Bands or teams or products they're unusually prone or disinclined to like? Putting all this stuff together, you can assign to each user a score, which represents your best estimate for the probability that the user has ties or will have ties to terrorist groups. It's more or less the same thing Target does when they cross-reference your lotion and vitamin purchases to estimate how likely it is that you're pregnant. There's one important difference. Pregnancy is very common, while terrorism is very rare. In almost all cases, the estimated probability that a given user would be a terrorist would be very small. So the result of the project wouldn't be a Minority Report-style pre-crime center where Facebook's panoptic algorithm knows you're going to do some crime before you do. Think of something much more modest, say, a list of 100,000 users about whom Facebook can say, with some degree of confidence, people drawn from this group are about twice as likely as the typical Facebook user to be terrorists or terrorism supporters. What would you do if you found out a guy in your block was on that list? Would you call the FBI? Before you take that step, do a computation. There are 200 million or so Facebook users in the United States. Any terrorist cells in the U.S. are surely pretty small. Let's say, to be as paranoid as possible, that there are 10,000 people who the feds really ought to have their eye on. That's 1 in 20,000 of the total user base. There are 100,000 people Facebook reckons as having an elevated chance of terrorist involvement. We'll take Facebook at their word that their algorithm is so good that the people who bear its mark are fully twice as likely as the average user to be terrorists. So among this group, 1 in 10,000, or 10 people, will turn out to be terrorists, while 99,990 will not. The thing to notice is that almost nobody on Facebook's list is a terrorist. In fact, there's a 99.99% chance that your neighbor is innocent. In a way, this is the birth control scare revisited. Being on the Facebook list doubles a person's chance of being a terrorist, which sounds terrible. But that chance starts out very small, so when you double it, it's still small. But there's another way to look at it, which highlights even more clearly just how confusing and treacherous reasoning about uncertainty can be. Ask yourself this: if a person is in fact not a future terrorist, what's the chance that they'll show up, unjustly, on Facebook's list? That's easy enough to compute. There are 199,990,000 non-terrorists, and of those, a mere 99,990 are on the list. So the chance that an innocent person will be marked as a potential terrorist by Facebook's algorithm is 99,990 divided by 199,990,000, or about 0.05%. That's right, an innocent person has only a 1 in 2,000 chance of being wrongly identified as a terrorist by Facebook. Now how do you feel about your neighbor? The reasoning that governs p-values gives us clear guidance. The null hypothesis is that your neighbor is not a terrorist. Under that hypothesis, that is, presuming his innocence, the chance of him showing up on the Facebook red list is a mere 0.05%, well below the 1 in 20 threshold of statistical significance. In other words, under the rules that govern the majority of contemporary science, you'd be justified in rejecting the null hypothesis and declaring your neighbor a terrorist. Except there's a 99.99% chance he's not a terrorist. On the one hand, there's hardly any chance that an innocent person will be flagged by the algorithm. At the same time, the people the algorithm points to are almost all innocent. It seems like a paradox, but it's not. It's just how things are. And if you take a deep breath and keep your eye on the numbers, you can't go wrong. Here's the crux. There are really two questions you can ask. They sound kind of the same, but they're not. Question 1. What's the chance that a person gets put on Facebook's list, given that they're not a terrorist? Question 2. What's the chance that a person's not a terrorist, given that they're on Facebook's list? One way you can tell these two questions are different is that they have different answers, really different answers. We've already seen that the answer to the first question is about 1 in 2,000, while the answer to the second is 99.99%. And it's the answer to the second question that you really want. The quantities these questions contemplate are called conditional probabilities, the probability that X is the case, given that Y is. And what we're wrestling with here is that the probability of X given Y is not the same as the probability of Y given X. If that sounds familiar, it should. It's exactly the problem we faced with the reductio ad unlikely. The p-value is the answer to the question, the chance that the observed experimental result would occur given that the null hypothesis is correct. But what we want to know is the other conditional probability, the chance that the null hypothesis is correct given that we observed a certain experimental result. The danger arises precisely when we confuse the second quantity for the first. And this confusion is everywhere, not just in scientific studies. When the district attorney leans into the jury box and announces, "There is only a 1 in 5 million, I repeat, a 1 in 5 million chance that an innocent man would match the DNA sample found at the scene," he is answering question 1. How likely would an innocent person be to look guilty? But the jury's job is to answer question 2. How likely is this guilty-looking defendant to be innocent? That's a question the DA can't help them with. The example of Facebook and the terrorists makes it clear why you should worry about bad algorithms as much as good ones, maybe more. It's creepy and bad when you're pregnant and Target knows you're pregnant, but it's even creepier and worse if you're not a terrorist and Facebook thinks you are. You might well think that Facebook would never cook up a list of potential terrorists or tax cheats or pedophiles, or make the list public if they did. Why would they? Where's the money in it? Maybe that's right. But the NSA collects data on people in America, too, whether they're on Facebook or not. Unless you think they're recording the metadata of all our phone calls just so they can give cell phone companies good advice about where to build more signal towers, there's something like the red list going on. Big data isn't magic, and it doesn't tell the feds who's a terrorist and who's not. But it doesn't have to be magic to generate long lists of people who are in some ways red flagged, elevated risk, people of interest. Most of the people on those lists will have nothing to do with terrorism. How confident are you that you're not one of them? Radio psychics and the rule of Bayes. Where does the apparent paradox of the terrorist red list come from? Why does the mechanism of the p-value, which seems so reasonable, work so very badly in this setting? Here's the key. The p-value takes into account what proportion of people Facebook flags, about 1 in 2,000, but it totally ignores the proportion of people who are terrorists. When you're trying to decide whether your neighbor is a secret terrorist, you have critical prior information, which is that most people aren't terrorists. You ignore that fact at your peril. Just as R.A. Fisher said, you have to evaluate each hypothesis in the light of the evidence of what you already know about it. But how do you do that? This brings us to the story of the radio psychics. In 1937, telepathy was the rage. Psychologist J.B. Rhine's book, New Frontiers of the Mind, which presented extraordinary claims about Rhine's ESP experiments at Duke in a soothingly sober and quantitative tone, was a bestseller and a Book of the Month Club selection, and psychic powers were a hot topic of cocktail conversation across the country. Upton Sinclair, the best-selling author of The Jungle, released in 1930 a whole book, Mental Radio, about his experiments in psychic communication with his wife, Mary. The subject was mainstream enough that Albert Einstein contributed a preface to the German edition, stopping short of endorsing telepathy, but writing that Sinclair's book deserves the most earnest consideration from psychologists. Naturally, the mass media wanted in on the craze. On September 5, 1937, the Zenith Radio Corporation, in collaboration with Rhine, launched an ambitious experiment of the kind only the new communication technology they commanded made possible. 5 times, the host spun a roulette wheel, with a panel of self-styled telepaths looking on. With each spin, the ball landed either in the black or in the red, and the psychics concentrated with all their might on the appropriate color, transmitting that signal across the country over their own broadcast channel. The station's listeners were implored to use their own psychic powers to pick up the mental transmission and to mail the radio station the sequence of five colors they'd received. More than 40,000 listeners responded to the first request, and even for later programs, after the novelty was gone, Zenith was getting thousands of responses a week. It was a test of psychic powers on a scale Ryan could never have carried out subject by subject in his office at Duke, a kind of proto-big data event. The results of the experiment were not, in the end, favorable to telepathy. But the accumulated data of the responses turned out to be useful for psychologists in a totally different way. The listeners were trying to reproduce sequences of blacks and reds, hereafter B's and R's, generated by five spins of the roulette wheel. There are 32 possible sequences, all of which are equally likely to come up, since each spin is equally likely to land red or black. And since the listeners weren't actually receiving any psychic emanations, you might expect that their responses, too, would be drawn equally from the 32 choices. But no. In fact, the cards the listeners mailed in were highly non-uniform. Sequences like BBRBR and BRRBR were offered much more frequently than chance would predict, while sequences like RBRBR are less frequent than they ought to be, and RRRRR almost never showed up. This probably doesn't surprise you. RRRRR somehow doesn't feel like a random sequence the way BBRBR does, even though the two are equally likely to occur when we spin the wheel. What's going on? What do we really mean when we say that one sequence of letters is less random than another? Here's another example. Quick, think of a number from 1 to 20. Did you pick 17? Okay, that trick doesn't always work, but if you ask people to pick a number between 1 and 20, 17 is the most common choice. And if you ask people for a number between 0 and 9, they most frequently pick 7. Numbers ending in 0 and 5, by contrast, are chosen much more rarely than chance would lead you to expect. They just seem less random to people. This leads to an irony. Just as the radio psychic contestants tried to match random sequences of R's and B's and produced notably non-random results, so people who choose random numbers tend to make choices that visibly deviate from randomness. In 2009, Iran held a presidential election, which incumbent Mahmoud Ahmadinejad won by a large margin. There were widespread accusations that the vote had been fixed. But how could you hope to test the legitimacy of the vote count in a country whose government allowed for almost no independent oversight? Two graduate students at Columbia, Bernd Baber and Alexandra Skocko, had the clever idea to use the numbers themselves as evidence of fraud, effectively compelling the official vote count to testify against itself. They looked at the official total amassed by the four main candidates in each of Iran's 29 provinces, a total of 116 numbers. If these were true vote counts, there should be no reason for the last digits of those numbers to be anything but random. They should be distributed just about evenly among the digits 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, each one appearing 10% of the time. That's not how the Iranian vote counts looked. There were too many sevens, almost twice as many as their fair share. Not like digits derived from a random process, but very much like digits written down by humans trying to make them look random. This by itself isn't proof that the election was fixed, but it's evidence in that direction. Human beings are always inferring, always using observations to refine our judgments about the various competing theories that jostle around inside our mental representation of the world. We are very confident, almost unshakably confident, about some of our theories. The sun will rise tomorrow, when you drop things, they fall. And less sure about others. If I exercise today, I'll sleep well tonight. There's no such thing as telepathy. We have theories about big things and little things, things we encounter every day, and things we've run into only once. As we encounter evidence for and against those theories, our confidence in them bobs up and down. Our standard theory about roulette wheels is that they're fairly balanced, and that the ball is equally likely to land on red or black. But there are competing theories, say that the wheel is biased in favor of one color or the other. Let's simplify matters and suppose there are just three theories available to you. Red, the wheel is biased to make the ball land on red 60% of the time. Fair, The wheel is fair, so the ball lands on red half the time and on black half the time. And black, the wheel is biased to make the ball land on black 60% of the time. How much credence do you assign to these three theories? You probably tend to think roulette wheels are fair unless you have some reason to believe otherwise. Maybe you think there's a 90% chance that fair is the right theory, and only a 5% chance for each of black and red. Those numbers are what we call in probability lingo the a priori probabilities that the different theories are correct, the prior for short. Different people might have different priors. A hardcore cynic might assign a 1/3 probability to each theory, while someone with a really firm pre-existing belief in the rectitude of roulette wheel makers might assign only a 1% probability to each of red and black. But those priors aren't fixed in place. If we're presented with evidence favoring one theory over another, say, the ball landing red 5 times in a row, our levels of belief in the different theories can change. How might that work in this case? The best way to figure it out is to compute more conditional probabilities. How likely is it that we'll spin the wheel 5 times and get R, 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 R? The answer depends on which theory is true. Under the fair theory, each spin has a 1/2 chance of landing on the red, so the probability of seeing R, 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 R is 1/2 times 1/2 times 1/2 times 1/2 times 1/2, or 1/32nd, which is 3.125%. In other words, R, 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 R is exactly as likely as any of the other 31 possibilities. But if black is true, there's only a 40% or 0.4 chance of getting red on each spin, so the chance of R, 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 R is 0.4 times 0.4 times 0.4 times 0.4 times 0.4, which is 1.024%. And if red is true, so that each spin has a 60% chance of landing red, the chance of R, 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 R is 0.6 times 0.6 times 0.6 times 0.6 times 0.6, which is 7.76%. Now, imagine there are 10,000 roulette wheels, and there are 10,000 rooms, each with a different roulette wheel, each roulette wheel with a person playing it. One of those people following one of those wheels is you, but you don't know which wheel you've got. So your state of unknowledge about the wheel's true nature can be modeled by supposing that of the original 10,000, 500 were biased toward the black, 500 were biased toward the red, and 9,000 were fair. The computation we did previously tells you to expect about 281 of the fair wheels, about 39 of the red wheels, and only 5 of the black wheels to come up R, 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 R. So if you do get R, 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 you still don't know which of the 10,000 rooms you're in, but you've narrowed it down a hell of a lot. You are in one of the 325 rooms where the ball landed on red 5 times in a row. And of those rooms, 281 of them, about 86.5%, have fair wheels, 39 or 12% have red wheels, and only 5, 1.5%, have black wheels. The more balls that fall red, the more favorably you're going to look on that red theory, and the less credence you'll give to black. If you saw 10 reds in a row instead of 5, the same computation would raise your estimation of the chance of red to 25%. What we've done is to compute how our degrees of belief in the various theories ought to change once we see 5 reds in a row, what are known as the posterior probabilities. Just as the prior describes your belief before you see the evidence, the posterior describes your beliefs afterward. What we're doing here is called Bayesian inference, because the passage from prior to posterior rests on an old formula in probability called Bayes' theorem. That theorem is a short algebraic expression, and I could read it out for you right here and now, but I'm going to try not doing that, because sometimes a formula, if you train yourself to apply it mechanically without thinking about the situation in front of you, can obscure what's really going on. The posterior is affected by the evidence you encounter, but also by your prior. The cynic, who started out with a prior that assigned probability 1/3 to each of black, fair, and red, would respond to 5 reds in a row with a posterior judgment that red had a 65% chance of being correct. The trusting soul who starts out assigning only 1% probability to the red will still only give it a 2.5% chance of being right, even after seeing 5 reds in a row. In the Bayesian framework, how much you believe something after you see the evidence depends not just on what the evidence shows, but on how much you believed it to begin with. That may seem troubling. Isn't science supposed to be objective? You'd like to say that your beliefs are based on evidence alone, not on some prior preconceptions you walked in the door with. But let's face it, no one actually forms their beliefs this way. If an experiment provided statistically significant evidence that a new tweak of an existing drug slowed the growth of certain kinds of cancer, you'd probably be pretty confident the new drug was actually effective. But if you got the exact same results by putting patients inside a plastic replica of Stonehenge, would you grudgingly accept that the ancient formations were actually focusing vibrational earth energy on the body and stunning the tumors? You would not, because that's nutty. You'd think Stonehenge probably got lucky. You have different priors about those two theories, and as a result, you interpret the evidence differently, despite it being numerically the same. It's just the same with Facebook's terrorist-finding algorithm and the next-door neighbor. The neighbor's presence on the list really does offer some evidence that he's a potential terrorist. But your prior for that hypothesis ought to be very small, because most people aren't terrorists. So, despite the evidence, your posterior probability remains small as well, and you don't, or at least shouldn't, worry. Relying purely on null hypothesis significance testing is a deeply non-Bayesian thing to do. Strictly speaking, it asks us to treat the cancer drug and the plastic Stonehenge with exactly the same respect. Is that a blow to Fisher's view of statistics? On the contrary, when Fisher says that no scientific worker has a fixed level of significance at which, from year to year and in all circumstances, he rejects hypotheses, he rather gives his mind to each particular case in the light of his evidence and his ideas, he is saying exactly that scientific inference can't, or at least shouldn't, be carried out purely mechanically. Our pre-existing ideas and beliefs must always be allowed to play a part. Not that Fisher was a Bayesian statistician. That phrase, nowadays, refers to a cluster of practices and ideologies in statistics, once unfashionable, but now rather mainstream, which includes a general sympathy toward arguments based on Bayes' theorem, but is not simply a matter of taking both previous beliefs and new evidence into account. Bayesianism tends to be most popular in genres of inference, like teaching machines to learn from large-scale human input, that are poorly suited to the yes or no questions Fisher's approach was set up to adjudicate. In fact, Bayesian statisticians often don't think about the null hypothesis at all. Rather than asking, does this new drug have any effect, they might be more interested in a best guess for a predictive model governing the drug's effects in various doses on various populations. And when they do talk about hypotheses, they're relatively at ease with talking about the probability that a hypothesis, say that the new drug works better than the existing one, is true. Fisher was not. In his view, the language of probability was appropriately used only in a context where some actual chance process is taking place. At this point, we've arrived at the shore of a great sea of philosophical difficulty into which we'll dip one or two toes, max. First of all, when we call Bayes' theorem a theorem, it suggests we are discussing incontrovertible truths certified by mathematical proof. That's both true and not. It comes down to the difficult question of what we mean when we say probability. When we say that there's a 5% chance that red is true, we might mean that there actually is some vast global population of roulette wheels, of which exactly 1 in 20 is biased to fall red 3/5 of the time, and that any given roulette wheel we encounter is randomly picked from the roulette wheel multitude. If that's what we mean, then Bayes' theorem is a plain fact akin to the law of large numbers we saw in the last chapter. It says that, in the long run, under the conditions we set up in the example, 12% of the roulette wheels that come up RRRRR are going to be of the red-favoring kind. But this isn't actually what we're talking about. When we say that there's a 5% chance that red is true, we are making a statement not about the global distribution of biased roulette wheels. How could we know? But rather about our own mental state. 5% is the degree to which we believe that a roulette wheel we encounter is weighted toward the red. This is the point at which Fisher totally got off the bus, by the way. He wrote an unsparing pan of John Maynard Keynes' treatise on probability, in which probability measures the degree of rational belief to which a proposition is entitled in the light of given evidence. Fisher's opinion of this viewpoint is well summarized by his closing lines. If the views of the last section of Mr. Kane's book were accepted as authoritative by mathematical students in this country, they would be turned away, some in disgust and most in ignorance, from one of the most promising branches of applied mathematics. For those who are willing to adopt the view of probability as degree of belief, Bayes' theorem can be seen not as a mere mathematical equation, but as a form of numerically flavored advice. It gives us a rule, which we may choose to follow or not, for how we should update our beliefs about things in the light of new observations. In this new, more general form, it is naturally the subject of much fiercer disputation. There are hardcore Bayesians who think that all of our beliefs should be formed by strict Bayesian computations, or at least as strict as our limited cognition can make them. Others think of Bayes' rule as more of a loose, qualitative guideline. The Bayesian outlook is already enough to explain why RBRRB looks random, while RRRRR doesn't, even though both are equally improbable. When we see RRRRR, it strengthens a theory, the theory that the wheel is rigged to land red, to which we've already assigned some prior probability. But what about RBRRB? You could imagine someone walking around with an unusually open-minded stance concerning roulette wheels, which assigns some modest probability to the theory that the roulette wheel was fitted with a hidden Rube Goldberg apparatus designed to produce the outcome red, black, red, red, black. Why not? And such a person, observing RBRRB, would find this theory very much bolstered. But this is not how real people react to the spins of a roulette wheel coming up red, black, red, red, black. We don't allow ourselves to consider every cockamamie theory we can logically devise. Our priors are not flat, but spiky. We assign a lot of mental weight to a few theories, while others, like the RBRRB theory, get assigned a probability almost indistinguishable from zero. How do we choose our favorite theories? We tend to like simpler theories better than more complicated ones, theories that rest on analogies to things we already know about better than theories that posit totally novel phenomena. That may seem like an unfair prejudice, but without some prejudices, we would run the risk of walking around in a constant state of astoundedness. Richard Feynman famously captured this state of mind when he said, "You know, the most amazing thing happened to me tonight. I was coming here on the way to the lecture, and I came in through the parking lot, and you won't believe what happened. I saw a car with the license plate ARW357. Can you imagine, of all the millions of license plates in the state, what was the chance that I would see that particular one tonight? Amazing." If you've ever used America's most popular sort of illegal psychotropic substance, you know what it feels like to have two flat priors. Every single stimulus that greets you, no matter how ordinary, seems intensely meaningful. Each experience grabs hold of your attention and demands that you take notice. It's a very interesting mental state to be in, but it's not conducive to making good inferences. The Bayesian point of view explains why Feynman wasn't actually amazed. It's because he assigns a very low prior probability to the hypothesis that a cosmic force intended him to see the license plate ARW357 that night. It explains why five reds in a row feels less random than RBRRB to us. It's because the former activates a theory, red, to which we assign some non-negligible prior probability, and the latter doesn't. And a number ending in zero feels less random than a number ending in seven, because the former supports the theory that the number we're seeing is not a precise count, but an estimate. This framework also helps unwind some of the conundrums we've already encountered. Why are we surprised and a little suspicious when the lottery comes up 4, 21, 23, 34, 39 twice in a row, but not when it comes up 4, 21, 23, 34, 39 one day and 16, 17, 18, 22, 39 the next day, even though both events are equally improbable? Implicitly, you have some kind of theory in the back of your mind, a theory that lottery games are, for some reason, unusually likely to spit out the same numbers twice in close succession. Maybe because you think lottery games are rigged by the proprietors, maybe because you think a cosmic synchronicity-loving force has a thumb on the scale, doesn't matter. You might not believe in this theory very strongly. Maybe in your heart, you think there's a 1 in 100,000 chance that there really is such a bias in favor of repeated numbers. But that's much more than the prior you assigned the theory that there's a weird conspiracy in favor of the 4, 21, 23, 34, 39, and 16, 17, 18, 22, 39 combo. That theory is crazy, and you are not stoned, so you pay it no mind. If you do happen to find yourself partially believing a crazy theory, don't worry. Probably the evidence you encounter will be inconsistent with it, driving down your degree of belief in the craziness until your beliefs come into line with everyone else's. Unless, that is, the crazy theory is designed to survive this winnowing process. That's how conspiracy theories work. Suppose you learn from a trusted friend that the Boston Marathon bombing was an inside job carried out by the federal government in order to, I don't know, garner support for NSA wiretapping. Call that theory T. At first, because you trust your friend, maybe you assign that theory a reasonably high probability, say 0.1. But then you encounter other information. Police located the suspected perpetrators, the surviving suspect confessed, etc. Each of these pieces of information is pretty unlikely, given T, and each one knocks down your degree of belief in T until you hardly credit it at all. That's why your friend isn't going to give you theory T. He's going to add to it theory U, which is that the government and the news media are in on the conspiracy together, with the newspapers and cable networks feeding false information to support the story that the attack was carried out by Islamic radicals. The combined theory, T plus U, should start out with a smaller prior probability. It is, by definition, harder to believe than T, because it asks you to swallow both T and another theory at the same time. But as the evidence flows in, which would tend to kill T alone, the combined theory T plus U remains untouched. Jokhar Tsarnaev convicted? Well, sure, that's exactly what you'd expect from a federal court. The Justice Department is totally in on it. The theory U acts as a kind of Bayesian coding to T, keeping new evidence from getting to it and dissolving it. This is a property most successful crackpot theories have in common. They're encased in just enough protective stuff that they're equally consistent with many possible observations, making them hard to dislodge. They're like the multi-drug-resistant E. coli of the information ecosystem. In a weird way, you have to admire them. The Cat in the Hat, the cleanest man in school, and the creation of the universe. When I was in college, I had a friend with entrepreneurial habits who had the idea of making a little extra money at the beginning of the school year by selling t-shirts to first-year students. At that time, you could buy a large lot of t-shirts from the screen printing shop for about $4 each, while the going rate on campus was $10. It was the early 1990s, and it was fashionable to go to parties wearing a hat modeled after the one worn by the Cat in the Hat. So my friend got together $800 and printed up 200 shirts with a picture of the Cat in the Hat drinking a mug of beer. These shirts sold fast. My friend was entrepreneurial, but not that entrepreneurial. In fact, he was kind of lazy. And once he'd sold 80 shirts, making back his initial investment, he started to lose his desire to hang out on the quad all day making sales. So the box of shirts went under his bed. A week later, laundry day came around. My friend, as I mentioned, was lazy. He really didn't feel like washing his clothes. And then he remembered that he had a box of clean, brand new, beer-swigging Cat in the Hat t-shirts under his bed. So that solved the problem of laundry day. As it turned out, it also solved the problem of the day after laundry day. And so on. So here was the irony. Everyone around thought my friend was the dirtiest man in school because he wore the same t-shirt every single day. But in fact, he was the cleanest man in school, dressed every day in a new-from-the-store, never-worn shirt. The lesson about inference, you have to be careful about the universe of theories you consider. Just as there may be more than one solution to a quadratic equation, there may be multiple theories that give rise to the same observation. And if we don't consider them all, our inferences may lead us badly astray. This brings us back to the creator of the universe. The most famous argument in favor of a God-made world is the so-called argument by design, which in its simplest form simply says, "Holy cow, just look around you. Everything is so complex and amazing, and you think it just glommed together that way by dumb luck and physical law?" Or, phrased more formally, by the liberal theologian William Paley in his 1802 book, Natural Theology, or evidences of the existence and attributes of the deity collected from the appearances of nature. He writes, "In crossing a heath, suppose I pitched my foot against a stone and were asked how the stone came to be there. I might possibly answer that, for anything I knew to the contrary, it had lain there forever. Nor would it perhaps be very easy to show the absurdity of this answer. But suppose I had found a watch upon the ground, and it should be inquired how the watch happened to be in that place. I should hardly think of the answer which I had before given, that, for anything I knew, the watch might have always been there. The inference, we think, is inevitable, that the watch must have had a maker, that there must have existed, at some time and at some place or other, an artificer or artificers who formed it for the purpose which we find it actually to answer, who comprehended its construction and designed its use. If this is true of a watch, how much more so of a sparrow, or a human eye, or a human brain?" Paley's book was a tremendous success, going through 15 editions in 15 years. Darwin read it closely in college, later saying, "I do not think I hardly ever admired a book more than Paley's Natural Theology. I could almost formerly have said it by heart." And updated forms of Paley's argument form the backbone of the modern intelligent design movement. It is, of course, a classic reductio ad unlikely. If there's no God, it would be unlikely for things as complex as human beings to have developed. Humans have developed, therefore it's unlikely there's no God. This is much like the argument that the Bible coders used. If God didn't write the Torah, it's unlikely that the text on the scroll would so faithfully record the birthdays of the Rebbes. You may be sick of hearing me say it by now, but reductio ad unlikely doesn't always work. If we really mean to compute in numerical terms how confident we should be that God created the universe, we'd better invoke Bayes again. The first difficulty is to understand the priors. This is a hard thing to get your head around. For the roulette wheels, we were asking, how likely do we think it is that the wheel is rigged before we see any of the spins? Now we're asking, how likely would we think it was that there was a God if we didn't know that the universe, the earth, or we ourselves exist? At this point, the usual move is to throw up one's hands and invoke the charmingly named principle of indifference. Since there can be no principled way to pretend we don't know we exist, we just divvy up the prior probability evenly, 50% for God and 50% for no God. If no God is true, then complex beings like humans must have arisen by pure chance, perhaps spurred along by natural selection. Designists then and now agree that this is phenomenally unlikely. Let's make up numbers and say it was a 1 in a billion shot. What if God is true? Well, there are lots of ways God could be. We don't know in advance that a God who made the universe would care to create human beings or any thinking entities at all, but certainly any God worth the name would have the ability to whip up intelligent life. Perhaps if there's a God, there's a 1 in a million chance God would make creatures like us. That's a small number, but much bigger than 1 in a billion. So our existence provides powerful evidence that God exists. This, in essence, is Paley's case, the argument by design, as a modern Bayesian type would express it. There are many solid objections to the argument by design, and there are also 2 billion fighty books on the topic of you should totally be a cool atheist like me, where you can read those arguments, so let me stick here to the one that's closest to the math at hand, the cleanest man in school objection. You probably know what Sherlock Holmes had to say about inference, the most famous thing he ever said that wasn't elementary. "It is an old maxim of mine that when you have excluded the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth." Doesn't that sound cool, reasonable, indisputable? But it doesn't tell the whole story. What Sherlock Holmes should have said was, "It is an old maxim of mine that when you have excluded the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth, unless the truth is a hypothesis it didn't occur to you to consider." Less pithy, more correct. The people who inferred that my friend was the dirtiest man in school were considering only two hypotheses. Clean, my friend was rotating through his shirts, washing them, then starting the rotation over like a normal person. And dirty, my friend was a filthy savage who wore dirty clothes. You may start with some prior. Based on my memory of college, assigning a probability of 10% to dirty is about right. But it doesn't matter what your prior is. Clean is ruled out by the observation that my friend wears the same shirt every day. When you have excluded the impossible, But hold up, Holmes. The true explanation, lazy entrepreneur, was a hypothesis not on the list. The argument by design suffers from much the same problem. If the only two hypotheses you admit are no God and God, the rich structure of the living world might well be taken as evidence in favor of the latter against the former. But there are other possibilities. What about gods, where the world was put together in a hurry by a squabbling committee? Many distinguished civilizations have believed as much. And you can't deny that there are aspects of the natural world, I'm thinking pandas here, that seem more likely to have resulted from grudging bureaucratic compromise than from the mind of an all-knowing deity with total creative control. If we start by assigning the same prior probability to God and gods, and why not if we're going with the principle of indifference, then Bayesian inference should lead us to believe in gods much more than God. Paley himself was surely aware of this issue. Note how careful he is to say artificer or artificers. Why stop there? There's no end to the making of origin stories. Another theory with some adherence is Sims, where we're not actually people at all, but simulations running on an ultracomputer built by other people. That sounds bizarre, but plenty of people take the idea seriously, most famously the Oxford philosopher Nick Bostrom, and on Bayesian grounds, it's hard to see why you shouldn't. People like to build simulations of real-world events. Surely, if the human race doesn't extinguish itself, our power to simulate will only increase, and it doesn't seem crazy to imagine that those simulations might one day include conscious entities that believe themselves to be people. If Sims is true, and the universe is a simulation constructed by people in a realer world, then it's pretty likely there'd be people in the universe because people are people's favorite things to simulate. I'd call it a near certainty that a simulated world created by technologically advanced humans would have simulated humans in it. If we assign each of the four hypotheses we've met so far a prior probability of 1/4, the evidence strongly favors Sims. Yes, the existence of human life is evidence for the existence of God, but it's much better evidence that our world was programmed by people much smarter than us. Advocates of scientific creationism hold that we should argue in the classroom for the existence of a world designer, not because the Bible says so, that would be unconstitutionally naughty, but on coolly reasonable grounds founded on the astonishing unlikelihood of the existence of humanity under the no-God hypothesis. But if we took this approach seriously, we would tell our 10th graders something like this. Some have argued that it's highly unlikely for something as complex as the Earth's biosphere to have arisen purely by natural selection, without any intervention from outside. By far, the most likely such explanation is that we are actually not physical beings at all, but residents of a computer simulation being carried out by humans with unthinkably advanced technology, to what purpose we can't exactly know. It's also possible that we were created by a community of gods, something like those worshipped by the ancient Greeks. There are even some people who believe that one single god created the universe, but that hypothesis should be considered less strongly supported than the alternatives. Think the school board would go for this? I'd better hasten to point out that I don't actually think this constitutes a good argument that we're all Sims, any more than I think Paley's argument is a good one for the existence of the deity. Rather, I take the queasy feeling these arguments generate as an indication that we've reached the limits of quantitative reasoning. It's customary to express our uncertainty about something as a number. Sometimes it even makes sense to do so. When the meteorologist on the nightly news says there's a 20% chance of rain tomorrow, what he means is that, among some large population of past days with conditions similar to those currently obtaining, 20% of them were followed by rainy days. But what can we mean when we say there's a 20% chance that God created the universe? It can't be that 1 in 5 universes was made by God and the rest popped up on their own. The truth is, I've never seen a method I find satisfying for assigning numbers to our uncertainty about ultimate questions of this kind. As much as I love numbers, I think people ought to stick to I don't believe in God, or I do believe in God, or just I'm not sure. And as much as I love Bayesian inference, I think people are probably best off arriving at their faith, or discarding it, in a non-quantitative way. On this matter, math is silent. If you don't buy it from me, take it from Blaise Pascal, the 17th century mathematician and philosopher who wrote in his Pensée, God is, or he is not. But to which side shall we incline? Reason can decide nothing here. This is not quite all Pascal had to say on the subject. We return to his thoughts in the next chapter. But first, the lottery. Part 3. Expectation. Includes: MIT kids game the Massachusetts State Lottery, how Voltaire got rich, the geometry of Florentine painting, transmissions that correct themselves, the difference between Greg Mankiw and Fran Lebowitz. I'm sorry, was that Beaufoche or Beaufogue? Parlor games of 18th century France, where parallel lines meet, the other reason Daniel Ellsberg is famous, why you should be missing more planes. Chapter 11. What to expect when you're expecting to win the lottery. Should you play the lottery? It's generally considered canny to say no. The old saying tells us lotteries are a tax on the stupid, providing government revenue at the expense of people misguided enough to buy tickets. And if you see the lottery as a tax, you can see why lotteries are so popular with state treasuries. How many other taxes will people line up at convenience stores to pay? The attraction of lotteries is no novelty. The practice dates back to 17th century Genoa, where it seems to have evolved by accident from the electoral system. Every 6 months, two of the city's governatori were drawn from the members of the petty council. Rather than hold an election, Genoa carried out the election by lot, drawing two slips from a pile containing the names of all 120 councillors. Before long, the city's gamblers began to place extravagant side bets on the election outcome. The bets became so popular that gamblers started to chafe at having to wait until election day for their enjoyable game of chance. And they quickly realized that if they wanted to bet on paper slips drawn from a pile, there was no need for an election at all. Members replaced names of politicians, and by 1700, Genoa was running a lottery that would look very familiar to modern Powerball players. Bettors tried to guess five randomly drawn numbers with a bigger payoff the more numbers a player matched. Lotteries quickly spread throughout Europe and from there to North America. During the Revolutionary War, both the Continental Congress and the governments of the states established lotteries to fund the fight against the British. Harvard, back in the days before it enjoyed a nine-figure endowment, ran lotteries in 1794 and 1810 to fund two new college buildings. They are still used as dorms for first-year students today. Not everyone applauded this development. Moralists thought, not wrongly, that lotteries amounted to gambling. Adam Smith, too, was a lottery naysayer. In The Wealth of Nations, he wrote, "That the chance of gain is naturally overvalued, we may learn from the universal success of lotteries. The world neither ever saw, nor ever will see, a perfectly fair lottery, or one in which the whole gain compensated the whole loss, because the undertaker could make nothing by it. In a lottery in which no prize exceeded £20, though in other respects it approached much nearer to a perfectly fair one than the common state lotteries, there would not be the same demand for tickets. In order to have a better chance for some of the great prizes, some people purchase several tickets and others small shares in a still greater number. There is not, however, a more certain proposition in mathematics than that the more tickets you adventure upon, the more likely you are to be a loser. Adventure upon all the tickets in the lottery, and you lose for certain, and the greater the number of your tickets, the nearer you approach to this certainty." The vigor of Smith's writing and his admirable insistence on quantitative considerations shouldn't blind you to the fact that his conclusion is not, strictly speaking, correct. Most lottery players would say buying two tickets instead of one doesn't make you more likely to be a loser, but twice as likely to be a winner. And that's right. In a lottery with a simple prize structure, it's easy to check for yourself. Suppose the lottery has 10 million combinations of numbers and just one is a winner. Tickets cost $1 and the jackpot is $6 million. The person who buys every single ticket spends $10 million and gets a $6 million prize. In other words, just as Smith says, this strategy is a certain loser to the tune of $4 million. The small-time operator who buys a single ticket is better off. At least she has a 1 in 10 million chance of coming out ahead. But what if you buy two tickets? Then your chance of losing shrinks, though admittedly only from 9,999,999 in 10 million to 9,999,998 in 10 million. Keep buying tickets, and your chance of being a loser keeps going down until the point where you've purchased 6 million tickets. In that case, your chance of winning the jackpot and thus breaking even is a solid 60%, and there's only a 40% chance of you ending up a loser. Contrary to Smith's claim, you've made yourself less likely to lose money by buying more tickets. Purchase one more ticket, though, and you are sure to lose money, though whether it's $1 or $4 million in $1 depends on whether you hold the winning ticket.